Like Dave mentioned, this is the last in our series this year on just the opening chapters of 1 Corinthians. And look, one of the themes that we've seen in this letter is how the Corinthian Christians had been influenced by their surrounding society, their surrounding culture. And James introduced us to a phrase a couple of weeks ago. It's a phrase that was thrown around in the first century. It's called being Corinthianized. Being Corinthianized. What that meant was you had been influenced by the very loose morals that the city of Corinth had, the Corinthian culture. And we've seen quite a few examples of how the Corinthian Christians have been Corinthianized. So they'd been Corinthianized in how they sought their significance in life through intellect in particular, and if not their achievements, chapters 2 and 3. They'd been Corinthianized in their very high tolerance of sin, like they tolerated very heinous sin. We saw that in chapter 5. And they'd been Corinthianized into dealing with disputes within the church by just dragging people into court. We saw that in the beginning of chapter 6. Today, we get to see yet another way in which the Corinthian Christians have been Corinthianized. And this time, it is through adopting the sexual morals of their society. What do I mean by that? I mean they had become very desensitized to things such as prostitution. In verse 16, we see that. Now, here's the thing. Prostitution is not a big issue in this church that I know of. All right? But that doesn't mean we haven't necessarily been desensitized in other ways by the sexual morals of our society. So let me give you an example. All right, when we watch a movie or read a book that has a boy meets girl subplot, all right, we will often find ourselves rooting for that couple to get together, will we not? I mean, that's the whole point of the story, you know. You build the romance, we want them to get together. But here's the thing. When they do finally get together, if they jump straight into bed, how does that make us feel as Christians? Like, do we find ourselves cheering for them? It's like, yes, they're now a real couple. Or do we sort of see ourselves just being resigned to it, saying, well, that's just what society does. It's no big deal. Friends, if we are not concerned over sex before marriage being a misuse of sex in the same way that prostitution is a misuse of sex, then we too are being desensitized to the sexual morals of our society. Excuse me. And as such, this is why we need to listen to what Paul is telling us in this chapter, because Paul is reminding us of God's perspective on sex. Yet this perspective is not what many of us might think. You see, in this passage, Paul doesn't just reject the very liberal view of sex that we see in this passage, that everything is permissible for me. He also rejects the very conservative view of sex that many in society also hold to, that says that sex is something dirty and something to avoid. Right? Paul does something completely different to both those things in this chapter. All right, what he does is he gives us a very elevated view of sex, a view of sex that is much higher than the liberal or conservative views of sex that are prevalent in our society and have been prevalent in all societies throughout history. But here's the thing. The real beauty of this passage is that Paul outlines God's view of sex for us in a way that makes us want to pursue God's ideal for sex. It makes us want to flee from sexual immorality. So friends, if we want to avoid being influenced by the sexual morals of our society, just like the Corinthians were, this is the passage for us. I've got 3 points to show us God's view of sex. You can see that on your sermon outline. We're going to begin by looking at what sex isn't. That's in verses 12 to 14, followed by what sex is, a good definition of sex in verse 16. And once we have those two basics, our third point is going to help us want to follow God's design for sex, which is what sex points to in verses 15 to 20. So let's dive in. So, page 1775, 1 Corinthians 6, verse 12, and it starts with a very strange phrase. Have a look at verse 12. Notice the inverted commas. I have the right to do anything, you say, but not everything is beneficial. I have the right to do anything, but I will not be mastered by anything. So what Paul is doing is he's picking up a phrase that the Corinthian Christians were throwing around, which was, I have the right to do anything. Or those who are familiar with the old NIV, you might remember, everything is permissible for me. Right? Everything is permissible for me. And the specific context of this phrase is in regards to sex. The Corinthians were saying, everything is permissible for me when it comes to sex, even prostitution. Verse 16. And look, this sounds hauntingly familiar to our culture, does it not? You see, if anyone in our society dares to suggest that certain sexual practices may not be beneficial today, they very quickly earn themselves titles such as narrow-minded, prudish, or a bigot. Now, the way our society justifies the very liberal view of sex that is being pushed is by saying things like, well, look, it's just sex. It's not that big a deal. All right, now what they're saying by that is they are thinking of it as a purely physical action that doesn't really hold any deep significance or meaning. And here's the thing, there's nothing new under the sun, because guess what? That's exactly what the Corinthians were saying as well. So in verse 13, Paul quotes another of their sayings. Again, you say, food for the stomach and the stomach for food. Now, what this phrase is getting at is it's saying, look, sex is nothing more than a physical appetite. Okay, so the Corinthians were saying, look, just like when I get hungry for food, we can go and have some food, so too when I get hungry for sex, then we should be allowed to just go and have sex. So like our society today, many in Corinth saw sex as a merely physical and therefore basically meaningless appetite. Therefore, everything sexual is permissible for me. Yet it wasn't everyone that thought that. Right? There was a good number in Corinth that thought that. But there was another section in Corinth that held to a more conservative view of sex. And we see this in chapter 7, verse 1. Now, it's not part of our passage, but it's the very next verse after our passage. So just flick over and have a look at what Paul says in chapter 7, verse 1. Now, for the matters you wrote about, again, look at the inverted commas. It is good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman. It is good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman. And look, this is the second common misconception about sex. Okay, so the first common misconception about sex is that sex is nothing more than a physical act that can be conducted according to our appetite, just like when we get hungry. The second common misconception, and remember, both are prevalent today and have been throughout history. The second common misconception is that sex is something dirty or defiling and therefore should be avoided. Now, this view of sex is very common among churches. Okay, the way some churches preach against sexual immorality is by declaring that sex is, look, necessary for procreation, but otherwise dirty and to be avoided. This is the main reason behind the Roman Catholic doctrine of the perpetual virginity of Mary. All right, so if Mary is this ultra-holy co-redemptrix, all right, co-redeemer, then this notion of her being defiled by actual sexual intercourse in any time in her life becomes abhorrent. And so the Roman Catholic Church placed this notion that sex is defiling over and above the plain reading of verses such as Matthew 1:25, which makes it abundantly clear that Mary, with her husband Joseph, had a normal sex life following the birth of Jesus. All right? They declared, rather, no, Mary remained a virgin her whole life. Right, so we've got these two views of sex, and Paul rejects them both. All right. Paul rejects the notion of lowering sex to nothing more than an appetite like food. Excuse me. But he also rejects the notion of lowering sex to something that is dirty and defiling. And friends, this is this is the first point of application for today. Okay, please do not be fooled into believing either of these misconceptions about sex. Sex is not just a physical thing, as we're about to see, but nor is it a dirty thing. Sex is different to both these things, as Paul goes on to mention in our second point in verse 16. So, what is sex? We know what it isn't. What is sex? And in verse 16, Paul elevates sex to give it the most positive definition that any human institution has ever given it on earth. So have a look at verse 16. He says, "Do you not know that he who unites himself with a prostitute is one with her in body? For it is said, the two will become one flesh." Now, what does this phrase "one flesh" mean? It's a quote from Genesis 2, which says that after a man has been joined to a woman in marriage, that the two become one flesh. Now, that's a reference to sex, okay? But here's the thing. Is this sexual union merely a physical one? Right? Are the Corinthians right in saying that sex is merely a physical coming together, just like food for the stomach? Well, friends, if that were the case, Paul would have used a different word than flesh, okay? Now, the Greek word translated body there, we see it. Do you not know that he who unites himself with a prostitute is one with her in body? The Greek word for that is soma. It just means your physical body, right? But Paul doesn't use that word in the quote from Genesis. He uses the word sarx. It's a Greek word sarx, which means flesh. And sarx has a broader definition than just the physical body. Right, we often translate sarx as sinful nature. There's something more, something deeper going on with the phrase sarx. And so what Paul is getting at here with the phrase "one flesh" is that there is something deeper going on in the act of sex than just the physical act. What that means is claiming that sex is no different to eating is actually a lie. And that lie leads all too many people to find out the hard way what sex is and what sex isn't. This is an article that was in the Sun Herald a couple of years ago. It was in the magazine, the Life magazine. It's written by a 54-year-old called Sarah Turner, but that's not her real name. She wrote under a pseudonym because the article was about her lamenting the dozens of men she slept with in her 20s. Okay, and so she wrote this article partly in the hope that her 10 and 11-year-old daughters don't make the same mistakes that she did. And she says this in the article. She says, "Of course, sex has a meaning beyond itself. It is not nothing." She says, "It's actually hard to strip sex of its mysteries." It's hard to strip sex of its mysteries, all right? What she's saying is it's not just a physical thing. This woman, right, not a Christian, found out through experience the exact same thing that Paul is declaring in 1 Corinthians 6. That is, sex has a meaning much deeper than just the physical act. That meaning, according to Genesis 2, is to build a relationship. Right? Sex is designed to bond two people together. Two people that otherwise would have a really tough time bonding, as all people do. But here's the thing, you cannot do that. You cannot build a relationship by being selfish, by making it all about me. And that's why sex is not designed primarily as a means of getting personal satisfaction. Right? Rather, I want you to understand this, sex is a way to donate yourself to another so deeply that the two of you become one unit. Right? Sex is a way to donate yourself to another so deeply that the two of you become one unit. And friends, any sex outside of marriage cannot do this. The main reason being you haven't done that with the person. You haven't committed yourself wholly to that person. Only in marriage do we commit ourselves wholly to another, whether it be economically, emotionally, financially, socially, physically. And what that means is that we must never have sex, never have physical oneness with someone until we have whole life oneness with them. This is why Paul says in verse 18, flee. Flee from sexual immorality. Don't sit there asking, oh, can I go this far? Can I go that far? Run in the opposite direction. That's what he's saying there, right? Now, the word translated as sexual immorality there is the Greek word porneia. It's where we get our word pornography from. Porneia is different to adultery. There's a completely different word for adultery. Paul does not use that word here, okay? Porneia refers to any sexual activity outside the bonds of marriage. Now, that includes adultery, but it also includes things like sex before marriage, polygamy, and pornography. And Paul says, do everything you can to run, flee from these things. Why? Because sex is not designed primarily as a way to get personal satisfaction. Now, that's not to say that sex is not satisfying, but it is the most satisfying when it is used the way that God wants it to be used. That is, to build a marriage. To build a marriage when you are donating yourself to another so that you become one unit. Friends, when we have sex outside of marriage, right, whether it be adultery or sex before marriage or polygamy or pornography and the like, there's other examples as well, what we're doing, we're not only dishonoring, but we're actually destroying God's gift of sex. And that comes at a very high price. But friends, if we can avoid that, if we can reserve sex for the one person we have covenanted ourselves to, then it results in what one preacher calls deep soul nurture and deep personal transformation and completion. Okay, committing yourself to someone for life not only means your soul is nurtured by your mutual love, but it means you become supplemented as a person, all right? Deep soul nurture and deep heart transformation and completion. Friends, do you see the high view of sex the Bible has? Right? It's not some physical act to be thrown around, nor is it a dirty act to be avoided. Sex is a physical donation of yourself to the person you've already donated the rest of yourself to in marriage. So why is it so hard to follow this? Why is it so hard for our society to flee sexual immorality? Why is it so hard for some Christians? Right? Why do so many Christians have sex before marriage these days? Why do some Christians have extramarital affairs? Why are so many Christians struggling with pornography these days? And can I say, a growing proportion of those people struggling with pornography are women. Why is that? Well, the reason is our society, including many Christians, are using sex to try and accomplish something it isn't designed to accomplish. Right? What I mean is, we're using sex to fill the void in our heart. So in that Sun Herald article, the author, Sarah, said, look, several of her sexual encounters occurred because the man seemed to expect it and she didn't want to disappoint. But she says the main reason she slept around was because, quote, her lack of self-esteem. Right? She said this, quote, a man wanting to sleep with me made me feel desired and powerful. I thought it gave me value. So much for sexual empowerment, unquote. See, what Sarah is getting at is that she was using sex selfishly. Rather than reserving sex to be a self-donation to the person she covenanted herself to, she was using sex to build herself up, to make herself feel accepted and powerful. And friends, the reason we misuse sex is because we have idolized sex in this way. We believe sex is what will give us our comfort, our acceptance, our security, and our power. Now remember, all humans are looking for those things: comfort, acceptance, security, and power. They're not bad things in and of themselves. We should all want those things. What is bad is when we use things like sex to try and get those things. Right? And like anything we idolize in this world and think that is what can give us our ultimate comfort, acceptance, security, and power, so too when we idolize sex, we ruin sex. Anything we idolize, we end up ruining. So what do we do? And if we're all looking for comfort, acceptance, security, and power, how can we ensure that we don't look to sex, idolize sex, in our attempt to find these things? Well, friends, it's by looking at something even better than sex to find those things. Right? It's by looking at what sex points to. Now, what do I mean by that? To understand what I mean by that, we need to notice that the verse that's talking about one flesh, right, what is sex, verse 16, is sandwiched between two sections that are talking about Christ. So verse 16, one flesh, this is what sex is. Have a look at verse 15. Do you not know that your bodies are members of Christ himself? And then verse 17, over the page, whoever is united with the Lord is one with him in spirit. Right? So what Paul is getting at is the thing we're looking for in becoming one flesh with someone we're not married to, that thing can actually only be found in Christ. Right? The only person that can fill the God-shaped hole in our heart is Jesus, God the Son. And so the best way to avoid misusing sex is to ensure that we don't use sex to find our comfort, our acceptance, or our power. Rather, we need to make Jesus our one true love. Now, this goes for married and single people all the same. Okay? You can misuse sex outside of marriage and inside of marriage. They both destroy the mechanism through which you are to achieve deep soul nurture and deep personal transformation and completion. We see this all the time in both single people and married people. Take single people, for example. We see it often. You get a young Christian and they become really interested in the cute boy or girl at school or at uni, and they don't go to church, but what they're really interested in them, and so they ask them along to church, and if that person says yes, then the Christian goes, good, now I'm allowed to date them because they've come to church, they must be a Christian, everything is okay. Yeah, what they're doing is they're lying to themselves, right? Because they are desperately looking for the opposite sex to fill that hole in their heart. And that's the kind of bad decisions we make when looking for a partner if we idolize sex. But the same can happen within marriage, right? If you have found a partner but are still idolizing sex, it's just as damaging, right? It means you are looking to your spouse to fill that hole in your heart. And what that ends up doing is crushing your poor spouse under the divine expectations you placed on them. And so even though you are having sex within marriage, you can't enjoy it. Because when we idolize sex, we just end up ruining it. Friends, the only way forward is to realize that sex is pointing to something greater. And what it's pointing to, I want you to hear this, it's pointing to that day when we will fall into the arms of our one true love, Jesus. You see, when used properly, sex gives us a small taste, but a small taste, of what it will feel like to have our soul perfectly nurtured and have our heart perfectly completed on that last day. And whether you're married or single, if we have turned to Christ, we will one day get to meet the one true spouse our hearts are all looking for. The way to ensure that that's our focus, okay, the way we transform our hearts so that we no longer want to misuse sex to get our comfort or acceptance or our power, the way we do that is to look to Jesus. And when we look to Jesus, what we see is Jesus donating himself for us. Right? Remember, sex is a self-donation so that you can build an intimate relationship. In order for Jesus to become intimate with us, he had to give himself wholly, didn't he? See, the cross is Jesus donating himself wholly, emotionally, socially, spiritually, economically, financially, and physically. And he did that for us. Friends, if we understand this, if we understand that Jesus could not become one with us in spirit, could not become intimate with us unless he donated himself wholly, that will stop us from saying to others, look, I'm going to use you for sex to get what I want out of it. I'm going to donate myself to you physically, but I'm not going to donate myself to you wholly. I'm going to hold on to the rest of my life. Thank you very much. Sex is to be reserved for donating yourself physically to the person you've already donated yourself to wholly. Now, before we close, I just want to say a quick word to those who may have blown it sexually. There's a very real possibility that there are people here who have sinned sexually, and when you hear sermons like this or read passages like this, you might have feelings of shame or dirtiness come over you. And if this is you, can I please remind you that in the Bible, Jesus interacts with several people who are sexually compromised, usually women. And he never treated them poorly. He always treated them with grace and acceptance, full acceptance. Now, he didn't accept the sin, all right? He said, repent and go away and sin no more. And that's what this passage is saying as well. But Jesus accepted them. And that's what he's done with every Christian in this room. Okay, so it doesn't actually matter what you've done sexually. That is nothing compared to the spiritual adultery that every single person in this room has committed against the Lord. Yet he has washed us clean through his self-donation. So friends, may we look to Jesus as our one true love, as our perfect spouse who donated his all for us. For if we do that, well, we won't need to use sex to find our comfort, acceptance, or power. Rather, we will be able to use sex the way it is intended, as a physical self-donation to the person we've already donated our whole self to in marriage.